Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Coronations are a wonderful thing in the life of a nation. They're wonderful because they're pageant, colour, drama, history on the hoof, and they describe the character of a nation. We look back and we look at the epochs of different monarchs, and each of them takes a different characteristic which we apply from the particular king or queen of the time. So we're moving into a new Carolingian era, and the auspices are good. The last Carolingian era was that of Charles II. It was the Restoration, theatre, joy, escape from the shadow of Puritanism, a period of hope and of new national identity. But it depends upon how you tell your history, if you tell it from a cultural point of view or from a perspective that allows you to develop a narrative in terms of national characteristics. There are innumerable ways of telling history. One of the ways, of course, is doing it through the eyes of faith, and particularly doing it through the eyes of a Catholic. Suddenly, the first Elizabethan era is no longer the era of Shakespeare and dramatic poets. It's no longer the era of stability and seeing off the Armada. It becomes the era of the one-party state, ruled by two Cecils with a powerful secret service, which drove Catholics underground and attributed to them motives of treachery instead of fidelity, treachery to the crown instead of fidelity to Jesus, hanging, drawing and quartering priests as if they were national enemies, all of them fostering revolution, when in fact they were serving the people of the country who had for 1,000 years been receiving Jesus in the Mass. And so as we come to today, how do we see the new Carolingian era? Do we see it as a time of the rejuvenation of national identity, a fresh start after a tired and long reign? What does the period of King Charles look like through Catholic eyes? As we look back through history, it's obvious that there's always a challenge between the church and the state. The followers of Jesus are in this world, but not of the world. And the whole institution of Christian monarchy has pursued a difficult act of trying to straddle the interests both of the church and of the people. The coronation oaths that go back to 903 involved, at the earliest point, three particular promises, a contract between the king and the people. The first question put to the monarch was, will you keep peace between the state and the church? Followed by, will you repress rapacity and iniquity? And thirdly, will you do justice in mercy and in peace? Well, the coronation oaths, of course, have evolved since the 10th century. It's worth for a moment reflecting on the history of the coronation oaths, and particularly going back to the Act of Settlement in 1701. This was the oath the monarch had to make. It's not friendly to Catholics. By the grace of God, King or Queen, do solemnly and sincerely in the presence of God profess, testify and declare that I do believe that in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper there is not any transubstantiation of the elements of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, at or after the consecration thereof, by any person whatsoever, and that the invocation or adoration of the Virgin Mary or any other saint, and the sacrifice of the Mass as they are now used in the Church of Rome, are superstitious and idolatrous. And I so solemnly in the presence of God profess, testify and declare that I do make this declaration and every part thereof in the plain and ordinary sense of the words read unto me, as they are commonly understood by English Protestants, without any such dispensation from any person or authority or person whatsoever, or without thinking that I am or can be acquitted before God or man, or absolved of this declaration in any part thereof, although the Pope or any other person or persons or power whatsoever should dispense with or annul the same or declare that it was null and void from the beginning. The declaration in that form was originally administered under the Test Act to all civil and military officials of the Crown, starting with the monarch him or herself, beginning with William and Mary. Interestingly enough, in 1910, George V refused to make that oath. In fact, he refused to open Parliament unless the oath was changed. He was not prepared to make an oath that was so profoundly anti-Catholic. So there is some scope for changing the coronation oath because it's evolved all the way through the last 1,000 years. In one sense, we can be pleased that test acts have disappeared and there is emancipation for Catholics. But in another sense, as we take the cultural temperature of our times, a new test act has come. It's not official, it's unofficial, it's not legal, it's cultural. But it has to do with Catholic beliefs and Catholic fidelity, in that, in pragmatic terms, it begins to outlaw them. We've entered a period where Catholics who believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman may find their rights of employment threatened. And so although King Charles is going to take a much more modified form of oath, where he simply declares to be a good Protestant king, it sets up a number of issues that require some kind of commentary and assessment. What's happening to our culture today? And what is the role of a king or a queen, in our case a king, who has very little power, though he does have some influence? Does it matter that the form of a coronation oath is profoundly exclusive still towards Catholics, promising to be a good Protestant, whilst at the same time ushering in a culture of diversity and inclusion for all other forms of belief except the Catholics? Is this just a formality, or is there something more important lying behind it that we might want to address? I was deeply struck the other day by hearing a piece of commentary from America which suggested that for the first time, the sense of common good that all parties, all politicians had in mind was no longer the same. Up until recently, it's been the case that the community would decide that there were certain values that all parties were working towards. They would involve freedom of speech, free employment, the flourishing of all people within the community, a healthy economy, a healthy system of human rights. But suddenly, suggested this particular commentator, it wasn't true anymore. We had entered a period where it was almost as if we were celebrating the culture of death. If you take the numbers of abortions, both in America and in the United Kingdom, we have begun to cull human life at a level that was inconceivable 50 years ago. If you look at the onset of euthanasia, the danger is that we will do the same at the end of life. And we have entered a period of the emasculation of our teenagers where, due to this explosion of gender dysphoria, we are castrating our children and our teenagers in ever-growing numbers without restraint. And the suggestion was that suddenly left and right no longer share a common good, but from the left, from the progressive ideologies, this pursuit of a culture of death is entirely different from those who would want to conserve values of Christendom as they've been understood for several hundred years. The problem with this sudden disparity between the two polarized wings of our community is that if we no longer agree on what the common good is, that's going to cause particular difficulties for those who adjudicate the values of our society. And even within a democratic monarchy, one of the roles of the king or the queen is to act as an adjudicator of our national vision. How can a monarch draw together a society that is becoming so polarized over profound ethical issues to do with life and death, whilst at the same time also polarized over issues of freedom of speech and freedom of conscience? We're entering a period of political paradox, or perhaps political and ethical contradiction. Progressive values are summed up in the DIE formula, D-I-E, diversity, inclusion, and equity or equality. One of the things a monarchy has to do is to bend with the times, to incorporate the zeitgeist to at least some reasonable extent. But what if the zeitgeist begins to take the monarchy so far away from its roots and the values that define it, that in the end this produces a crisis of identity? After all, you could hardly think of an institution that was less diverse, less inclusive, and less equal than the monarchy itself. There is no diversity in a single family that defines itself exclusively by blood ties. There is no inclusivity unless you include the small number of people who marry into it. And there's certainly no equality in a monarchy which depends upon the notion of hierarchy stretching right the way from the top to the bottom of society. And yet, Charles has, for some very understandable reasons, positioned his monarchy in a place where he seems to embrace all the values of diversity and inclusivity and equality. The coronation itself is going to involve LGBTQ choirs in order to prove the credentials of the monarchy in terms of its cultural width and largesse. And Charles has gone much further. He's decided that it would be acceptable to slim the monarchy down and to some extent to demystify the whole liturgy upon which the coronation is based. Elements that have been common to coronations for 1,000 years are being changed. It used to be that the peers would all express their homage for the king or the monarch by touching the crown and kissing him on the cheek as a sign of feudal commitment. There'll be no more kissing under Charles, no more touching of the crown. This will all be done by waves of acknowledgement. It used to be that the bread and the wine of the offertory procession would be brought up to the monarch, and instead Charles is not going to receive the bread and the wine. He will wave and acknowledge their presence rather than act out the full liturgical choreography of the Anglican Eucharist. Commentators were surprised to discover that there was a delay in the publication of the coronation liturgy, and as leaks began to appear, the suggestion was that behind this delay was a conflict between Charles and canon lawyers. King Charles had for a long time said that he wants to be not defender of the Protestant faith, as the oath requires, but actually defender of all faiths. It was never clear how seriously he should be taken, and the thought was that he might grow out of this relativistic largesse. But one of the first acts on the death of his mother was to draw together all the faith leaders in the country and to bring them into one place and to gather them together in order to express his commitment to the integrity of all faiths. In one sense, this appears to be a generous and kind, inclusive act. But it suffers from the problem that the faiths themselves don't understand themselves in this particular way. Several of them are exclusive rather than inclusive. They depend upon objective and absolute claims and repudiate the whole culture of relativism. There's something quite culturally, colonially patronising in terms of imposing a relativistic secular worldview on ancient faiths that repudiate it in terms of their own self-understanding. But intellectually, colonial or not, Charles was determined to have his own way, and it looked for a while as though one of the things he wanted to do was to have members of different faiths take part in the Christian liturgy in Westminster Abbey. Well, the canon lawyers told him that this was legally impossible. Legally, interestingly, because parliamentary law, which underwrites canon law, forbade it. And whether or not this was a private sticking point for the king, the parliamentary lawyers, the canon lawyers, had their way. No Muslim, Hindu, Jain or Zoroastrian is taking part in the liturgy. Instead, what Charles did was to express his desire to be defender of all faiths by drawing together a large interfaith procession at the end of the service, and one also in which representatives of different faiths in the House of Peers carried regalia into the coronation service, symbolising the breadth of his interfaith commitment. We'll come back to the interfaith elements in a moment, but one of the great pities is a way in which much of the liturgy has been slimmed down and diluted. We've talked about the lack of the kiss of homage, but the Lord Great Chamberlain, instead of kneeling down to touch the king's heels with the spurs, just presents them to the king, and the king just acknowledges them. This looks like a wave of the hand is required. Remarkably, the Archbishop doesn't put the rings on the fourth finger of the king's right hand and that of the queen. He just, again, presents them. No touch. What do? You've guessed it. They wave. They acknowledge them. And then they're put back on the altar. But why? This is the wedding ring of England. Aren't the putting of the ring on the finger and the wearing of it indispensable signs of the covenant made between prince and people, which elsewhere this new liturgy makes something of? And whereas in 1953 at the offertory, the bread and the wine for the Eucharist were handed to Queen Elizabeth, who then gave them to the Archbishop, King Charles will merely, yes, you guessed it, wave. He'll acknowledge them. What lies behind all this? This lack of touch, this watering down of the choreography of the coronation, feels like it's almost a desacramentalizing of it. Clearly, people wanted the service shortened, but to leave out the litany before the service begins seems a major loss for those people who think that prayer is a good thing. Not many people are going to notice that they've taken out the confession and the absolution, of course, but also the Nicene Creed, which leaves the impression that this is a church and a monarchy that doesn't really have much sense of personal sin or an interest in Christian doctrine. So much of it is just not very well done. Some of the liturgical draftsmanship is really rather poor. The collect and the introduction to the first reading are embarrassingly substandard. Anointing and crowning are mentioned the wrong way round in the Archbishop's introduction, and the opening dialogue with a chorister is, well, it's a bit cloying, really. But let's go back to relativism and being defender of all the faiths. The problem is that for Christianity, the whole panoply of reality depends upon absolute and objective truth. Of course, that's not true for other religions. There are schools of thought in Sikhism which are perfectly happy with relativism, and also in Buddhism. Hinduism has no theological difficulties in accepting degrees of truth in other religions. But all the presuppositions in Catholicism and Christianity depend upon an absolutist and, although the word is contested, an objective standard of reality. John Paul II wrote some very powerful things about it, but Benedict XVI is particularly good. In April 2005, in his homily during Mass prior to the conclave which would elect him as Pope, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger talked about a world that was moving towards a dictatorship of relativism. Here's what he wrote. Look how powerful it is. Quote, "How many winds of doctrine we've known in recent decades, how many ideological currents, how many ways of thinking. The small boat of thought of many Christians has often been tossed about by these waves, thrown from one extreme to the other, from Marxism to liberalism, even to libertinism, from collectivism to radical individualism, from atheism to vague religious mysticism, from agnosticism to syncretism, and so forth. Every day new sects are created, and what St. Paul says about human trickery comes true with cunning which tries to draw these into error. Look at Ephesians 4:14. Having a clear faith based on the creed of the church is often labelled today as a fundamentalism, whereas relativism, which is letting oneself be tossed and swept along by every wind of teaching, looks like the only attitude acceptable to today's standards. We are moving towards a dictatorship of relativism, which doesn't recognize anything as certain and which has as its highest goals one's own ego and one's own desires. However, we Catholics have a different goal. The Son of God, true man, he is the measure of true humanism. Being an adult means having a faith which does not follow the ways of today's fashions or the latest novelties. A faith which is deeply rooted in friendship with Christ is adult and mature. It is this friendship which opens us up to all that is good and gives us a knowledge to judge true from false and deceit from truth." And perhaps with Benedict's words ringing in our ears, we can re-examine the die culture. One of the greatest problems, of course, is with the notion of inclusion. What inclusion does is to sabotage any exercise of the gift of discernment. For a Christian, one of our primary theological and moral tasks is to be able to distinguish good from evil. Right at the beginning in the narrative of Genesis, we discover that the human dilemma is summed up rather neatly by the realization that just because we can do something, can we live with the ethical consequences? Can we tell good from evil? And the answer is, we're very bad at it indeed. In fact, St. Paul tells us that it's not just a matter of common sense and intellectual capacity, but actually there's something of a spiritual gift of discernment, this perception of what is really true and what is really evil. And it's no accident, of course, that everything presents itself as good. Even the Nazis presented themselves as good to the people they were trying to win over. The Marxist totalitarians at the other end of the scale present their goals and their methods as good. Telling the difference between good and evil is one of the most difficult things that human beings have to do, and it's a particular Christian charism. But if we are sabotaged by any notion of inclusion, which means everything gets included in, nothing is better or worse than any other, then out of the window immediately goes the capacity to perform this profoundly important theological and ethical task. The relativistic framework, the whole mantra of diversity, inclusion, and equality removes from Christians, removes from the church, not only the duty, but even the possibility of telling good from evil. So it's a problem in a coronation where we discover that the mindset that King Charles is adopting and the liturgy itself moving away from the absolutist, objective Christian view of the world to a more relativistic and inclusive one in order to gather in faiths, multi-faith culture as a way of placating the zeitgeist. There's no harm at all in gathering different religious leaders together in a procession and inviting them to carry some of the symbolic accoutrements of the coronation. But the difficulty is that's not exactly where Charles wants to stop. He's made it clear that his notion of faith is a Jungian one. The only distinctions that Jung was willing to make in the world of faith was whether or not they helped with the whole process of self-actualization. Self-actualization in Jungian terms, individuation, is almost impossible to define. So the whole exercise is effectively one that is redundant, but it sounds good and it sounds generous and warmly welcoming. But this is perhaps where we get to the nub of things, where incongruity becomes contradiction. Catholics will have to live with the oaths that swear Protestant fealty to set up a Protestant, non-Catholic political settlement. That the notion that faiths can live together is illusory. The Archbishop of Canterbury and Lambeth Palace have issued a text which says the intention of the whole multi-faith environment is to be able to protect all people of all faith so that they can live and act freely. But that's exactly the point, where in fact the reality is that different faiths compete and jockey for power and position, and some are willing to use force and blackmail and means that are entirely illegitimate in a free society in order to get their way, well, a different kind of protection is required, a protection that does indeed protect the freedom of conscience. And it just so happens that in our culture, the people who appear to need protecting most are the Christians. Of course, the king has very little political power anymore. It's mainly cosmetic, but he does have influence. And in a society that has become increasingly secular, and some would say anti-Christian, where people who believe above all in the sanctity of life and that marriage is in the Christian framework between a man and a woman with the intention of having children, and where even believing in biology rather than the power of the imagination to create a whole plethora of genders, where such beliefs can damage your employability and even verge towards hate crime. As a matter of freedom of conscience, this is an element of religious faith and commitment that needs some kind of protection. A number of Catholics have written saying they welcome the fact that Charles is willing to defend the Protestant religion. Better to defend some religion than none, they say. Well, that's a view people are entitled to have, but only if the protection actually takes place. And just at the moment, the whole relativistic framework, the interfaith spectrum, the commitment to relativism rather than absolutism, suggests that there won't be any protection from the influence of the king for Christians in this particular realm. Well, of course, it's too early to know. The king has hardly started on his reign, and he's entitled to invite us to wait and see. And some of the ways in which King Charles has worked in the background whilst he was Prince of Wales have been enormously admirable and very attractive. The Prince's Trust was something that should have had a great deal more publicity and support, and for which he deserves a huge amount of credit. So he's entitled to ask us to wait and see, to wait and see where he puts the weight of his influence. He was well known as Prince of Wales for writing off spidery notes to ministers asking them to explain themselves or expressing his views. He got into a little bit of trouble for that. But on the whole, no one can really blame him for trying to exercise some degree of responsibility. That's indeed what we're asking for. And so perhaps as king, he'll be able to continue in the same vein in order to be able to express the responsibilities that he has to freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, and the freedom of the integrity of the individual. These can't be taken for granted as the whole political momentum of wokeness begins to tighten its grasp around the public airways. Let's return to the words of Pope Benedict, given on World Youth Day in August 2005, as he sums up part of the political problem that we're facing in these decades. In the last century, he wrote, we experienced revolutions with a common programme expecting nothing more of God. They assumed total responsibility for the cause of the world in order to change it. And this, as we saw, meant that a human and partial point of view was always taken as an absolute guiding principle. Absolutizing what is not absolute but relative is called totalitarianism. It does not liberate man, but takes away his dignity and enslaves him. It is not ideologies that save the world, but only a return to the living God, our Creator, the guarantor of our freedom, the guarantor of what is really good and true. And so if the Archbishop's creative writing team really mean what they say in terms of positioning King Charles through the liturgy and the oaths he makes to commit him to being a guarantor of religious freedom, then it must be, following Pope Benedict and the teaching of the Church, it must be to encourage him to return to the teaching of the Christian faith, which is not relativist, not interfaith, not multicultural. There's a strategic misjudgment involved here too. If one looks at the statistics, the majority of people under 60 don't believe in the monarchy, have very little understanding of the historic role it plays, even in keeping us from the political preferences of presidents. But the very people who are likely to support the monarchy when it gets into trouble are going to be the Christians. By offering himself as a hostage to fortune, to the non-Christian culture, Charles makes himself and his monarchy dependent upon a group of people whose outlook is disinclined to take and to value the concept of monarchy seriously. For the concept of monarchy is essentially a Christian one. By slimming down the Christian content of the coronation, by diminishing the sacramental symbolism, by embracing multi-faith, multiculturalism and relativism, Charles is moving away from his natural, philosophically friendly support base. One can see the point of trying to establish, if not a feudal relationship anymore, but some kind of covenant of mutuality between king and people. And presumably that was what lay behind the idea, again from the Lambeth Palace creative writing team, that there should be some opportunity for the couch potatoes, the tourists on the street, the people who've come to celebrate and wave their hats, to commit themselves in an act of mutual allegiance to the king. And the form of words they have come up with is that for everyone to say at the end of the service, I swear that I will pay true allegiance to your majesty and to your heirs and successors according to law, so help me God. At which point there'll be a fanfare, after which Mr. Welby will say, God save the king. And we'll be invited to say, God save King Charles, long live King Charles. But then, unfortunately, adding the phrase, may the king live forever. Well, for those of us who are semi-biblically literate, the phrase, may the king live forever, takes us back to Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. It is indeed the kind of thing you would say to a totalitarian Persian monarch. The thing is, one shouldn't say things one doesn't mean, and no one actually means, will King Charles live forever? No one would want someone to live forever, to be locked forever in time and space. It's a silly thing to say, and the problem is that it devalues everything that's gone before it. Perhaps at the very best, we can hope that what it does is make people think about the words. if you want to get some sense of how ridiculous this appears to the general public, just look at the comments on Mumsnet. They are, to put it politely, underwhelmed. Well, we will end the coronation with our own best wishes to the king, praying that God may indeed save the king, that he may save his soul, that he may save his monarchy, that he may save his family. But we make this as a theological and a spiritual prayer, an act of Christian faith, rather than a form of political, over-idealistic well-wishing. Commentators have made a great deal of the fact that our coronation service stretches back to Anglo-Saxon liturgies. So perhaps one of the ways we can pray for King Charles is to pray an ancient Anglo-Saxon prayer, the Lorica, the prayer of protection of Gildas, written in the 6th century, a prayer for the king. Help, unity of Trinity, have pity, Trinity of unity, help me, I pray, thus placed as in the peril of a great sea, so that the plague of this year draw me not with it, nor the vanity of the world. And this very petition I make unto the high powers of the heavenly warfare, that they leave me not to be harried by enemies, but defend me with their strong armour, that before me in the battle go those armies of the heavenly warfare, cherubim and seraphim with their thousands, Gabriel and Michael with like ones, may thrones, powers and angels, principalities, dominions, angels, defend me with their thick array, and be strong to overthrow my enemies. Then also the other arbiters of the strife, patriarchs four, prophets four, apostles, watchmen of the ship of Christ, and the athlete martyrs all, I ask, and adjure also all virgins, faithful widows, and confessors, that safety compass me by them, and every evil perish from me. May Christ make with me a strong covenant, he whose terror scares away the foul throngs. God save the king.